It's one of the pieces of advice that, you know, we give people starting a company is, look, ultimately think of the people you're employing at one level, the people you're interacting with as partners, and the people you're servicing, which are your customers. And you just need to align all three of those to make it work.
Hello and welcome to episode 47 of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast. I'm your host, Gary Fox. I hope, first off, that you're safe and well wherever you are in the world during this crazy time that we currently live in. If I can help you at any stage during this time, do reach out. All my social channels are open and my website has a list of resources for entrepreneurs that can help them with financial aid, mentoring, and free software. So do get in touch if I can help you at all. That's what the whole ethos of the podcast is all about, is creating a community of great entrepreneurs all around Ireland and all around the world that can help each other and bounce back quicker from this. And speaking about bouncing back, we have a brilliant episode today that should give you some hope and inspiration for living in the post-COVID world. We have Brett Myers and Paul Byrne. Brett is the founder and ex-CEO of Currency Fair, and Paul is the current CEO. So a really cool dynamic between the two guys and myself. It's the first time I've ever had a founder and a current CEO on together. So they give a really interesting insight into how the business started and how it's now transitioning forward to a new stage. Currency Fair is doing really well at the moment, helping people move their money all around the world as they either move home or move abroad for work or whatever is happening in the world. So it's a really interesting insight into how a big company is operating. And I break that down. I ask the guys to break that down for smaller entrepreneurs. So at the end, there's a hugely helpful section whereby the guys run through what they would do if they were a small entrepreneur running their business. So I think it'll be very helpful to entrepreneurs like myself and entrepreneurs of a similar size who are figuring what to do with their smaller businesses. So stick around to the end and check that out. So here we go. Episode 47 with Brett Myers and Paul Byrne from Currency Fair. Enjoy. Paul, Brett, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Gary.
So we have a unique three-person podcast today. So maybe we'll just give a quick overview of who's here. So Paul, do you want to kick off and just give a quick overview of yourself?
Yeah, sure. I'm Paul Byrne, the CEO of Currency Fair. I guess I started my career way back as an accountant, Pricewaterhouse, back in the 1980s, recessionary environment. And I ended up working with them in Ireland and the States, the UK. And after that, I started down the entrepreneurial route. I worked with a company called Trintech, where I raised funds for it. Late 1990s, took it public on the NASDAQ and was director there for about 11 years. And along that journey, I founded two businesses, one in treasury and one in healthcare management. And they did really well, mostly in the States. 2010, started to work with a private equity firm to build another company on the back of the Trintech business called Cadency. That did really well. It grew that to basically about 60 million revenue in 4 years. And then we ended up selling that to another private equity firm, in which case I retired back to Ireland. I was a customer of Currency Fair, actually, and that's how I came in touch with Brett originally.
You're reading my questions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it was great. I actually, because we had our sell price was in US dollars. So I used Currency Fair then to transfer some of the dollars back into euros. And that's how I came in touch with the company. And then we had a mutual connection through one of Brett's investors at the time, Frontline Ventures. So I knew some of the guys there from way back in the day. So I got in touch with Brett, and that's how I really got involved in Currency Fair. I invested a little bit in the company, joined Brett, working with Brett on the team first, and then we kind of reversed roles. I took over as CEO and Brett is a board member.
Yes, that's actually one thing you've sped through so much there. There's a lot to unpack, so we'll have fun doing that. That was actually one question I was actually, we'll come on to it later as to how you guys actually just kind of switched roles. So Brett, you want to kick off and give an intro to yourself?
Yeah, sure. So it should become clear from my accent after not too long that I'm actually from Perth originally, but I'm in Ireland now 20 years. So most of my working life was away from Perth. I started off as an electrical engineer, believe it or not, working in oil and gas, and then I sort of swiftly moved into programming roles, sort of a self-taught programmer really, and that led me into finance. So I ended up working for banks. Which then really is what led to the idea of Currency Fair, both my financial background plus the fact that I was an expat and therefore I often had to convert money. So as a programmer, I sort of learned finance as I went into banking, and then I ended up having the programming skills to write in a lot of the initial back-end algorithms, if you like, for Currency Fair.
Okay, so you were totally self-taught?
On the programming side, yep. Yep, self-taught. And how did a few big thick books.
How did that even come about? How do you decide, yeah, you know what I'm going to do this weekend? Some programming.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was working in Perth as an engineer, and I had a good buddy of mine who was living in London, and he was working as a programmer over there and said, hey, why don't you come over? I can get you a job as a programmer in London. So I packed up and came over and literally learned on the job.
And what was your job then in London? What brought you over?
In London, I was in London for 2 years and I was working as a programmer in really just Microsoft Access and Visual Basic for an engineering company. So it was, each role has kind of transitioned halfway into the next one, you know.
And then you made the jump to Dublin or Ireland?
Yeah, I came to Dublin in early 2000. Thought I'd be here for 6 months, to be honest. It was just a real sort of bit of an extension of the working holiday. And yeah, came for 6 months and been here now 20 years.
And did a job bring you over? Did you just fancy living somewhere new or what was it?
It was literally... I was on working holiday visas at the time. Visa ran out in London. To be honest, I'd kind of had enough of London by that stage after 2 years. Found I could get a one-year visa for Ireland, came over and did that. And then liked it over here so much that I, back then, I guess it was early 2000s and there were shorter programmers. So it was actually reasonably easy to get a visa to stay longer as long as you were working in those industries where there were shorter people like IT at the time. So that allowed me to extend for a few years rolling over, and then I naturalized as an Irish citizen in, I think it was 2009. So I'm Irish now.
Okay. What a...
Proud Irish.
What were you working at when you came over? Were you programming? Or because it's a big move to come over just for 6 months and then, you know what, stay forever and get naturalized.
Yeah. Well, I was working, again, programming. The first job I had over here was an insurance company. And then the second one was a bank. So that's where I started to really pick up the financial side. But again, the programming I was doing was very much desktop, Visual Basic, that kind of thing. It wasn't really web programming. It was, databases mainly.
Okay, and so bring us then on to the Currency Fair journey. How did that start?
Yeah, well, I guess the idea came about really in from two directions. The first was that as an expat, I often needed to convert money. So sometimes I'd be sending money back to Australia. Other times I'd need to bring money over. And after doing a few transactions like that over the years, I finally I kind of realized actually how expensive it was to do it. It's they kind of the banks used to charge an upfront fee, which you tended to make you think that was the only fee. You know, I'm paying $30 to transfer this money, or 35 euros or whatever it happened to be. But when I realized that the margin the banks were building into the exchange rate was usually north of 3%. So Australian banks would usually charge you about 5% of your money every time you moved it. I started to think that's not really very fair and there must be a better way to do this. And as I had other friends over here that had just come out, there was some occasions where I realized that I was sending money back home where my friend was bringing money back the other way. Uh-huh. So one day I actually said, hey, why don't you just send me the Australian dollars into my Australian bank account that you were going to send over here, and I'll give you some euros that I was going to send back there, and we'll cut out the middleman. Both save 3-5%, and also we don't have to pay any international transaction fee because it's just domestic transfers on each end, and so it actually a bit of a network of friends developed where we'd do this. And then at the same time, I had seen back, I think it was sort of 99, 2000 times, a company quite well known now, but new back then called Betfair. And what they did was really revolutionized the betting industry by allowing people to bet against each other on a big marketplace, you know, so you could offer up some odds and someone else could match them off. And sort of over the years, I guess from, early 2000s to mid 2000s, this idea began sort of percolating in my head that what if we could take that principle of having a marketplace-based exchange, but do it for people that wanted to move money. So you didn't have to go find a friend of yours every time you wanted to transfer money. You could open this up to a bigger network and host a marketplace which was regulated and provide all the trust that was necessary. So that was really where the idea came from. What I guess was the catalyst to kicking off was probably the financial crisis. And I think if you look back, quite a lot of fintechs did start in that period of a few years after the financial crisis, because you had a lot of people who were working in finance, maybe either lost their job or found that their job was not as attractive as it used to be, and they decided this was the moment to you know, put some of their ideas into practice. And that's really what happened with us as well.
How did you, I think the first step would be, how did you even take the first step? Because money just seems like such a huge barrier to entry for something like fintech. There's so many, maybe I'm just perceiving it, but there's so many, it seems to be so many regulations and barriers you've to go over. So what was your first step?
Yeah, it's a good question, because starting off is in some ways quite a difficult thing. There's plenty of people, you know, in the early years of Currency Fair, we had a number of people who spoke to us and said, "Hey, I had this idea as well." So, you know, but it's great that you guys have actually done it, you know? So, I think I had three other co-founders when I started, and we all, I'd met them all individually, but they didn't know each other. But we had been talking about the idea amongst ourselves for quite a while. Getting started was really, I think we all just sat around a table one day and said, "Look, why don't we actually make a go of this? You know, and we had the naive idea that we'd all be able to continue with our day jobs, work on it in the evenings and the weekends, and then somehow all on one day we were going to quit our jobs and launch. You know, that was the original idea. But we talked about it. We started doing exactly that, working on our evenings and weekends. We got talking to Enterprise Ireland, and quite early on they gave us a big vote of confidence and put us on their high potential startup program.
Okay.
And then we end up talking to a few different mentor type people who told us that this whole idea of doing it in your evenings and weekends and going live in one day isn't going to work. You know, you need to think about raising some sort of amount of capital to kick it off. So we bandied around different ideas for doing that for a while. And then we end up doing a large friends and family round. Three of the original four founders were in banking or finance. And so we knew a few people that, you know, had a chunk of money they might think about investing. So I spent the summer of 2009 emailing, talking to, calling loads of different friends, and we ended up doing our very first round was, I think, about €400,000.
Wow, that's a big first round.
Yeah, well, there were 46, I think, different shareholders in that round.
So wow.
And this is not a strategy I'd recommend, because you do it with quite a complicated cap table, which has to be cleaned up down the line. But, you know, it was a good way to get us started. It got us the servers. I mean, back in those days, it was kind of halfway between now and a long time ago, in the sense that nowadays you can start off pretty quickly with Amazon and various other tools. We actually were at the time where cloud was just being talked about as an idea, and it was working in certain instances, but people didn't feel it was that secure in a lot of areas. So we actually had our own servers and a rack in a data center. And so we had a bit more of an upfront cost than you would have now.
Okay.
But 400K seemed to be a reasonable amount to get us going.
And did that prompt you guys to leave your jobs and go at it full time, or what was the transition then?
Gradually, yeah. I mean, two of us went full time straight away. And we started working on it, and then the third guy, John, came on maybe 3 or 4 months later, and so we could try to minimize salaries. None of us, unfortunately, had enough money that we could afford to work for nothing at the start, so we still did need to take some sort of salary, even though it was lower than what we were used to. But we needed enough to get by, so we couldn't all go full-time straight away. We did transition, and so by the time we went live, we had all four of us on board.
What was the timeline between starting, getting the funds, and going live?
So we started working on it at the start of 2009, really. That was just the sort of weekend stuff and evenings. We had two of us full-time by, I think it was around June or July. Which was roughly around the time we raised the money, and the first round anyway. And then we went live on near the end of April the following year, 2010. Okay. So it was quite a lot of upfront work to get it. You know, you can imagine we had to get regulated. It was moving people's money around is not something that you can just throw together on a website and kick off. You know, there's a lot of groundwork to be done.
Yeah, so kind of bring me through that. How did you even know what to do? How did you even know, okay, we need this license or this, we need to satisfy this regulation? What happens?
Yeah, well, we literally just talked to people. I mean, we were in finance. One of the original founders, Sean, was an FX trader on a treasury desk at a bank, and so he had some knowledge really in terms of getting banking partners arranged. Because even though we were kind of undercutting the banks, if you like, from the FX part, we still needed banks because we have to be able to receive and pay out money. So we need local banking services. So he was instrumental in getting that side of it set up. On the regulatory side, we just engaged a consultant and asked the questions. We actually got caught in a bad time because I remember in 2009 was when the payment services regulations actually came into force. So we actually started, did a whole application under the old process, and then we're told, oh, sorry, well, we're not going to regulate you under that because it's changing over. So we had to start again and start from scratch.
Was that as a result of the crisis, was it, or what brought that in?
I don't think it was directly as a result of the crisis, but I'm not 100% sure on that. It was a European-wide payment services directive, it was called, that each country then had to implement over a timeline. So.
Okay, so 2009, that would have been pretty much the middle of the recession?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it was really 2007 and 8 where everything tanked in the housing and the securitization markets in the US, wasn't it? And then the recession kind of kicked off from there. So yeah, that, I think that was important that it was in the recession for us in some ways.
Why was that?
Because one thing we found, we knew it would be hard, but we maybe didn't know quite how hard it would be, is getting people to change behavior is really, really difficult. No matter how compelling your proposition is, people are inherently just want to keep doing what they've always been doing. So, you know, the fact was you could transfer money with us and you would literally pay 90% less than you would with a bank, right? So, and yet people still didn't immediately switch. You know, it'd be great to think everyone was rational and go, well, I shouldn't be paying 10 times what I need to pay, why don't I just use this? But it didn't happen. And I think it did happen for us faster because of the fact that it was a recession. So people wanted to save money. You know, if you could imagine during the boom in Ireland, would people have really taken the time to sign up with a new provider? That certainly people I spoke to thought they had tons of money, you know, but come into a recessionary type environment and anything you can save suddenly becomes hugely more important. So that helped. But also what helped us a lot was we were able to get a lot of really good press coverage early on. I remember within maybe 2 months of launching, we had almost a full page article in The Guardian on our company. And that was purely because we were saving people money. It was a recession. We were a challenger to the banks. And if you remember at the time, banks were not very popular back in those days, right? So you had everything in our favor that, you know, journalists wanted to write about this thing. When we got this massive article in The Guardian, I remember someone from Enterprise Ireland who used to head up their financial division in London actually rang us and said she couldn't remember the last time an Irish company had got such a big article in such a major publication. And then because of that demographic of that readership, we ended up getting a lot of customers who were retired British expats living out in Spain and France and needed to send over pension payments or savings and so on. So press early on was hugely important for us. And I think it was largely driven by the environment we were in at the time.
That's so interesting. I think people discount press an awful lot because, you know, it's not digital and sexy, but the impact it can have, especially when, you know your market, like you guys knew who you wanted to target. How did the Guardian article come about? That's so massive.
Yeah, I can't remember. Like the very first article we got was in Australia, in The Australian, which was kind of quite nice for me, I guess, being from there, along with one of my other founders was from there, co-founders. And that was in our first week of launch. And that was due to a trade mission. We went down with Enterprise Ireland to Australia, and I got chatting to a journalist on that. But the Guardian one was maybe a couple of months later. And I think by that stage, we'd had a few articles in some other publications and maybe it got picked up through there. And so I think with that one, someone just contacted us and one of the journalists just contacted us. So they obviously heard about us from somewhere else.
It's amazing once you get one bit of validation from somewhere, some other media will inevitably start to nibble on it as well.
Definitely, yeah. And when trust is important to you, like it is with a financial business, then press is great because, you know, people read something in the paper and they just assume that it, you know, that the journalist has done all their due diligence for them, you know, and that it must be fine to use them. So I think it was pretty good for us.
That was one of the questions I had, actually. I put out on social media that I was going to be chatting to you guys, and one person contacted me and asked, as a young startup, how did you build trust? Because obviously you're dealing with people's money. It's the most important thing in the world to a lot of people. How did you guys build that early?
Yeah, well, partly the press, you know, those sort of articles lent trust. We had all the top-notch security on the website, you know, but I guess every website says it has top-notch security, but we made a point of making that clear. We were regulated. which obviously we had to be, but, you know, we made that very clear as well. And then you really just try and be an open and honest in your communications. We also wanted to make sure that we always answered the phone. And so we'd have, you know, four, or even when there are five, six of us, we all had the phone lines at our desk, and we'd all pick up, answer calls, and we wanted to make sure we answered every call and got back to emails really quickly, because we thought that would help with the trust factor. I think if you're a bit unsure about a company and you can't reach them on the phone straight away, then that's not going to help either. So it was just a lot of little things, really. There was no magic bullet on trust, but it was just a combination of all of those things.
Okay, so that brings us up to 2008-ish. I'm going to jump over to Paul. You mentioned you started numerous companies there. Can you just bring me quickly through the kind of how you started, or even why you started transitioning from accountant to founder?
It happened by, I guess, chance initially, in that in 2001, there was a NASDAQ crash. So there was a US recession, and we suffered because of that. Like, our revenue dropped dramatically overnight, and we ended up having to reduce our headcount at the time from about 630 people down to about 50. So it was a huge reduction in staff, and we did it over two or three tranches. So I ended up initially managing the program because I was the finance guy. And then ultimately I ended up just taking over the remnants of the company that was left in terms of managing, you know, the remaining business and trying to get it back up and grow again. So I was literally, in some respects, thrown at the deep end to actually take over running a business that we were trying to turn around at the time. And probably was the best thing that ever happened, because, while, you know, the old sink or swim analogy doesn't really work for everybody, it kind of worked for me, and it got me hooked on terms of being an entrepreneur. And like, both of my parents are entrepreneurs. You know, I come from a farming background, and my mother used to run a B&B basically as well, and she was quite early on in starting the Irish Farmhouse Association for like farmhouse holidays back in the 1960s. So like, I come from that kind of small business background. So that really got me engaged. And in 2005, then we started a treasury company, which I didn't start, but I took over managing a treasury business. I didn't found that, but I grew it. And I had two other guys, that Irish guys actually, were living in the States at the time. They joined me in managing the company, and then the three of us then founded the next two businesses together.
Okay.
So like Brett, guys I knew that I could, you know, that I worked with before. So we started this healthcare business in Chicago, 2007, and it was a fantastic business. We were trying to help hospitals save money in terms of getting reimbursed the correct amounts from the insurance companies, which is a hugely complex business in the States. In fact, it's never been solved, even to like 12 years later, it's still a problem. So we started a business in Chicago because there were a lot of med tech startups in Chicago generally. So it was a good base of employees, you know, which to draw from in terms of a startup. There was a direct flight from Dublin to Chicago, which made it easier to get home. And then there were also flights every hour to Dallas. And Dallas is where the other two guys were living at the time, and where I had been based with the treasury company. So it kind of geographically was a great idea. Weather-wise, it was terrible. It really was. Freezing cold in the middle of winter. And then, you know, baking hot in summertime. But the business was fantastic. And we started, like, we got that to about 10 million revenue in about 2 years. And then we sold it. We didn't want to sell it, but we were very, really lucky that in 2009, which was in the middle of the crisis, we managed to get the largest healthcare provider in the US to sign a five-year contract with us to enable us, our software, to run their kind of whole invoicing and billing scheduling for 178 hospitals.
Wow.
And that was fantastic. And they were really supportive of us as a small company. They liked us as individuals. Spent a lot of time in working with them in Tennessee. But then we realized we probably didn't have enough people to service the contract. So we actually got one of their existing partners to buy the company. Right, so it was somebody who already had a contract with them in the same area, like a public company called the Advisory Board, and they ended up buying our business, a healthcare business. So that was great. And then,
were they a rival to you guys, or how did that happen?
No, they were a consulting company.
Okay.
So they were actually providing consulting services in the same area as our software was solving problems for. So they knew about our software. They probably had used it in some of the hospitals anyway, in terms of helping the hospital manage their whole processes better. So that was kind of a pretty seamless transition in one respect, because the people we sold it to understood the business intimately. So it was, you know, wasn't that difficult to sell.
How did that happen though? How did you go from, you know, 2 years sale? Like, how did even sales process start? How, you know, did you kind of go?
Oh, we had a bank.
We
had an investment bank who actually helped us, because at some point we were going to have to raise a lot of money for this company or do something with it. So we actually had an investment bank who were helping us from Chicago, and we got to know them pretty well. So they basically helped us, through a process of either funding or selling. And then when it became clear like the funding would work, even though it was in the middle of a recession, which wasn't easy to raise money in, the sale was better for the business. And like we knew the people in the healthcare business really well at the customer level. And we didn't really want to let them down, because they have to place a huge vote of confidence in us, like a small company winning a huge big contract. So the sale made more sense for us. But that just, I guess, fueled our ambition then even further to start the next company. Because the next, after we, I think we probably hadn't even finished celebrating the sale of the previous one when we concocted the idea for the next one. And it is true, we did concoct it on a napkin in a bar.
Origin story, go on.
We did it. We have been a public company as well, so we knew all the problems public companies had in month-end accounting and reporting.
Okay.
And the consulting company we sold our healthcare business to had the same issues in healthcare businesses. So we knew pretty well that there was a problem to be solved for. So we devised a proposition for a SaaS product called Cadency, and we literally scoped it out, knew exactly what it needed to do. We were able to leverage products we already had worked on before in the treasury area.
Okay.
So we kind of knew what we knew. The idea wasn't new to us. Like, we knew the problem. We knew there was a solution that we could create for it. And we got backing from a private equity firm, our high growth in Boston. So we literally drafted it all out basically on a napkin in a bar in Texas. And then over the next couple of weeks, we started working on the idea. We created, it took about probably around 10 months to really bring something to market from a product point of view. And then 2011, 2016, it kind of grew pretty aggressively and pretty well. And we ended up hiring a lot of salespeople and expanded the headcounts probably to around 220 or so.
2011, that's again, like Brett, in the middle of the recession.
Yeah.
Did you have any kind of doubts, or did you have any kind of like, oh, wait, this mightn't fly at this time?
No, I think Brett and I have one thing in common, is that we're both probably eternal optimists. Because you'd have to be an optimist to start a company, because, you know, because if like, you're, otherwise you'd be second guessing yourself the whole time. Mm-hmm. So we were pretty confident there was a need. We had somebody who was prepared to support us from an investor point of view, and we knew there was a problem to be solved, and we knew how to solve the problem. And we'd had the problem ourselves, because I was CFO of this public company, you know, going back before him. So we knew exactly what the issue was. And the trick for us really was to try and get the first couple of customers signed up. So you asked Brett about how do you build trust in financial services, which is a different plan than building trust in like an enterprise software business. Like enterprise software, you basically need your first two or three clients, you know, to implement the software for the trials or whatever to go well, and then them to give you references. Like, the difficulty is people get fed up giving references the whole time, all the time. Mm-hmm. So you got to keep building and building momentum. So we needed a couple of early wins, and we got them. We had a few kind of friendly customers. In fact, some of the customers in the healthcare business also needed the software on the business side. So we were able to go back to them as well and get them to agree to trial the software. So we got up and running, and we were fortunate with the funding, because we had one investor who was prepared to put a lot of money into the company to actually fund the growth. So we didn't need, like Brett, to do an angel round or to bring a lot of investors along. We only had one other investor, which was, and it worked and it took off. And then
was this someone you'd worked with before? I noticed you kind of have a thread of, you obviously have an excellent stellar reputation wherever you go, and you just keep building and building. Was this someone you'd worked with previously who knew your credibility?
Yeah, what happened was that we didn't know them, but they knew us, because when we were in the healthcare business, we had a couple of partners as well, like, and one of those partners, their main investor was Spectrum Equity from Boston. So they knew all about us because they'd heard about us from their investee company. So we never met Spectrum at all until they came along and met us at the end of 2010 and talked about, you know, our company, what we were going to do next. And it was through that whole conversation that, you know, we ended up basically doing something with them. So it literally was working with people who knew us, and they turned out to be a fantastic partner for us. And then working with people I'd worked with before. It's like Brett, when he started the Currency Fair, you generally start business with people you know and you can trust. It just gets easier, and we were able to divide the work between the three of us. So it was unusual. You know, you had a company based in Texas, in Dallas, three Irish people running it, basically employing lots of American people, and ended up employing lots of 50 people in England and a few in Australia and all over in Hong Kong and all over the world. So it was great to start, because people would always ask you, why did three Irish guys start a company in Texas? And it really was great, because we could have meetings with people that nobody else could get, because we leveraged the Irish-American angle. We leveraged Enterprise Ireland where we could. We were able to have conversations with people about, you know, things in terms of why did we start in Texas? So people were naturally curious about what we were trying to do. And the fact that we already had experience made it easier to have a real conversation, because we knew exactly what we were talking about, because we all lived it before.
People love stories.
And that was it. It took off then, and it worked out great for us. Worked out really well. Three finance guys. Although I suppose I hadn't been working in finance since about 2002, 2003. So I've been out of the finance realm for a stage 9 years.
Okay.
The second guy, from Cork, he had been out of finance about 6 years, because he had been the product manager in the healthcare business. So he was really on the product side.
Okay.
And then the third guy from Kildare, he was basically operations, finance, HR. He was everything as well.
And how did you build a SaaS product though? That's what I'm trying to figure out, is how did three Irish guys in Texas build a SaaS product then?
We designed what it needed to do, and we knew where to get the building blocks from. So we were able to basically we actually bought a small business as well, which already had R&D capabilities in order to help us grow it and scale it. And in fact, it's probably even easier to start now, because as Brett said, there's so much open source software now, so much cloud software available, and so many, I suppose, offshore engineering centers. You know, it's probably easier even starting now than it was back then. But back then, and then as we developed and grew, we couldn't find enough engineering people fast enough locally. So we ended up, first of all, going to India. And then that was fine, but it was too far away, you know, time zone-wise. Mm. So we ended up opening a shared service center or center in Costa Rica, which was pretty neat, because it was same time zone as Texas. And it was about a 2.5 or 3 hour flight, like literally direct south flight.
Not a bad place. I can't think of it was not a bad old spot to be heading down to.
No, it was handy. No, it was grand, actually. It was great for and then some of our customers had operations down there as well. So
is that what brought you there?
And two of our customers helped us. Two of our larger customers helped us set it up. You know, and these are two like massive public companies in the States, and they actually helped us set it up basically as well, because. Like, people were invested in our success. Like, we had great customers who really wanted us to succeed, and they were prepared to help, basically as well, which was great.
What drove that though? Because it seems to be a marker of all your relationships, is strong interrelationships with clients. It's not like a them and us situation, which is very common. So how did you foster that?
I guess I have a philosophy, and in fact, I have to say, there's something actually I noticed when I joined Currency, but Brett had it as well. It was business is all about people. Right. Ultimately, you know, people make sales, people build software, people, you know, service or do provide customer service to other people. So we were very much always a people company. You know, the way, even when we sold, the way we were able to, pay bonuses to our staff out of the sales proceeds, which they weren't expecting and things like that. Like, we were very people oriented. We had to be. Like, don't forget, we were like growing the company, hiring lots of new people who didn't know anything about the company when they were hired. So therefore, it had to be, you know, onboarded pretty quickly. That had to be trusted pretty quickly, because, you know, you couldn't micromanage people and hire them that fast. So we got really strong around culture, around processes, around accountability, around, I guess, self-accountability probably more than anything else. So we really were people-oriented. I know it you say you start. We started as three accountants, right? At the end of the day, accountants generally aren't known for their people skills.
I'm glad you said that, not me.
Yeah. I was waiting for it. I got to get it out there first. We were a bit different, I guess, because we'd all been on the business side, you know, for a while, and we all knew about the value of relationships. So we really were partnered with people. Like we weren't. It was look, every relationship wasn't perfect. You know, some of our customers, you know, did have issues and challenges around using the software. We had to step in and get them, you know, fixed if there were bugs. So basically but you generally, you know, met people halfway or more than halfway. So like we did have one situation where we had one very large public company, and there was a bug in the software and it didn't work. And it was genuinely causing them issues. So, so what I did was I just flew to their head office and got a meeting with the group CFO and the chief accounting officer at the time. And the CAO was very unhappy with the software and really not keen to keep going with the contract. And I had said, look, it's software. We make mistakes. It was our mistake. We're fixing it. But just step back and think of the bigger picture here. Once you guys get up and running fully, look at what it's going to do for your company and your savings. I got the CFO to agree with me, and that kind of smoothed the waters. And, you know, that was just an example of how ultimately relationships are what drives every business forward. And Currency Fair is no different. Like ultimately our customers trust us with their money, and it's their money, not our money. So, you know, it's about relationships. And
I think it's fascinating for a SaaS company to say that, though, for a primarily computer software-based company to actually have people at the front. I think that signifies something very special about it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's one of the, I suppose, pieces of advice that, you know, we give people starting a company is, look, ultimately think of the people you're employing at one level, the people you're interacting with as partners, and the people you're servicing with your customers. And you just need to align all three of those in some way to make it work.
That was business is about people. 2011 to 2016 for you.
Yeah, 16. Then 16, we sold the company to a private equity firm, another private equity firm based in Austin, Texas, called Vista Equity Partners. And then I actually, I stayed on with them for 6 months to do a transition, because at that point I was definitely, you know, coming back to Ireland full time. I've been traveling back and forward for about 15 years.
Okay. Was that the reason for the sale, or what prompted this sale?
No, the sale, they came to us. They approached us and over a year, they made a couple of offers over the space of a year. And then finally, they made us an incredibly generous offer. And we decided, like, okay, now is as good a time as any, because the offer was so good.
There's enough zeros at the end.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So it was, you know, and it was probably, I wouldn't say there's never a right time or wrong time. Sometimes you're in the right place at the right time. And we were, and sometimes you're a bit lucky. And we probably were lucky as well. And when that moment happens, then you just got to be realistic. You know, as much as it pained us at the time to actually sell the company because we were in a significant growth trend, we also have to be realize that, look, somebody else investing more capital in the company can make it grow faster and make it more successful. And frankly, since we did sell the company, it's gone from strength to strength. Like they've probably doubled revenue again. They've made two acquisitions. You know, it's now a phenomenal company in the US. So, yeah, it was a good time to come back to Ireland. And then I came back and I was probably 6 months. I decided I wouldn't do anything for a while. And people had advised me, I talked and said, look, don't rush into the next thing. And I need a bit of consulting. You know, I started a business called Accelerate Success, which was free mentoring on a paid forward basis for small startups in Ireland.
That's a good idea. And
you know, and that worked out quite well, and basically as well, I made some investments through that vehicle too in smaller businesses. Mm. And then I got more involved with Brett, you know, in terms of getting more involved in Currency Fair, because while I was a customer of the company, I actually didn't know Brett personally. And then I got to meet Brett then through mutual contacts at Frontline Ventures, and that's how we kind of got involved.
I'll jump back over to Brett now in a second, but I just want to talk to you on that mentoring thing. Is that still running?
I still do mentoring, yeah, but I don't do as much of it, to be honest, because like obviously this is Currency Fair is full time. But yeah, I do have I mentor a couple of companies still, and I have a couple of investments as well, and I kind of try to help them out. But to be honest, I actually did find that one of the challenges of mentoring is that when you're doing it for free, people don't necessarily listen. you know.
That's why I'm asking you, because I know I get asked a little bit more, much more successful friends of mine get asked all the time. And we were having that debate literally only a few weeks ago. So it's interesting you bring it up, is that it's free, you know, you invest hours and hours into it, but then there's no kind of follow through on it. So yeah, how did you?
Well, started charging for it.
Yeah, that's what I thought the answer would be. Yeah,
I did, and I found people listen more. And it was pretty simple. Like, you know, it was their time and their money, right? So consequently, they were more invested then at that point in trying to get value for their money or their investment. I still did like, you know, what I would call coffee mentoring, right, for smaller startups, like people with maybe 10 people or less. And, you know, meet people for coffee and I still, by the way, I still do that today. Like, I'm happy to meet anybody who's kickstarting a business for a cup of coffee. And if they want to bounce some ideas off me or ask me a question, you know, I'm not opining on their business proposition or their marketplace but if they've got practical issues around how do you start off, where do you go, how do you get your first customer, I'm happy to do that. And that's fine, because that's just helping people out. That's what we all need to do, right?
Yeah. It's a fine line, I think. I think it's very difficult as well. How do you find that line between mentoring, advice? You know, because you want to help everybody. You do want to pay it forward, as you say. So it's a fine one.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. And I found actually it was easier paid forward when you charge people for it, because then there was much more focus. And then people could come with an agenda. You know, if they have specific things they want to focus in on, if they're part of a program, basically, as such.
Cool. Brett, bring us up from, so we finished with you in 2010. So kind of bring us forward for the next kind of 4 or 5 years of the journey up to where Paul was.
Okay. Well, a huge amount happened over in that period.
I know, it's a long question. It's a very expansive question. So go wherever you want with it.
we took off pretty well initially with the press articles, and, you know, we had a smallish marketing budget. Just mainly digital type marketing, and we were getting really good growth, primarily driven by sort of free-ish channels like the press and through referral, word of mouth. So that proved to be our strongest channel, and is still one of the strongest, if not the strongest channel today, because we were offering such a compelling value prop compared to what was already out there that people just wanted to tell their friends. And because a lot of our customers were expats as well, expats tend to have a pretty strong network. You know, you tend to hang around with other people from home, and you do, believe it or not, talk about things like sending money. So we boring as it sounds, it's actually a big topic of conversation among expats. So we were getting driving a lot of growth through that way. And likewise, as we grew, the normal things started to happen. In the sense that I remember clearly one of our biggest challenges, I think, early on would have been literally when we moved from about 12 people where we were sitting in one room. So we, you know, early on we were in a serviced office building. So we had our own room, but in this shared workspace type thing. And we got to about 12 people where we managed to have one long room where we were all at the one table. And then we got an extra couple of people and we split out into two rooms. And that was mainly the tech group split out from the rest of the group. And that was a challenge. We didn't really realize at the time what a challenge it was, but looking back, you know, that is one of the challenges of scaling is, you know, when all 12 of us were in this one room, we heard, you know, all the tech people heard the phone calls that someone was getting from a customer about something that wasn't working, you know, so everyone was just up to speed on what was going on. As soon as we separated, that became a lot more difficult.
So interesting.
And I think it's true with every business. It's that real challenging point where you can no longer rely on everyone knowing what's going on, and you have to suddenly start devoting a lot of time and energy into communication across the company. And then as you get bigger and bigger, that you know, obviously just gets worse and worse and more and more of a challenge, right, to keep up to date with that. And so that happened. We moved offices a couple of times, and as we got bigger, you know, we started to develop all the processes and procedures that are required to make things work at a larger scale than when it was small. So that's one thing I remember. We also did a lot of funding rounds, and looking back, I wish we'd raised more less frequently, because I think I spent probably roughly 7 years as CEO. I was probably more than 50% of my time was in fundraising or fundraising related activities rather than building the business. And that's because we did a lot of rounds. We you know, every growing startup company has to balance, you know, the aggression of trying to expand versus consolidating, you know, the business that you have. And the way we set our pricing and everything initially is that we knew that we could operate the business, the underlying business, at a profit. In other words, even though we were charging very little for these transactions, because we had good technology and ways of doing things, we make a profit per transaction. We can keep the thing running, but at the same time, you need to be hiring more tech people because you want. There's all these other products you want to do. There's various other things you're looking at. So you're trying to. You're always losing money because you're investing a lot of money to expand and getting that balance right. And based on your calculations of how much you need to raise in your runway, one of those is your revenue and how much you expect that to grow. And so we were trying to balance that. And looking back, we should have raised more money or done a little bit less on the money that we had, because we were always trying to push it too fast, if you like, for the amount of money we'd raised, which meant that pretty much as soon as you closed a round, you had to start thinking about the next round.
Okay. Is there an element of that, though? I know friends of mine who have fundraising or fundraising now, there's an element of you have to always nearly be raising because the social proof of seeing a raise triggers interest in a bigger raise. How did you balance that? Like, how did you go, okay, we need to raise X this time?
It was partly we had a goal for what we'd raise, and then partly it was driven by investors and those discussions. And so, I mean, we did, I don't even know, Paul might know how many actual rounds we did, but it was a number of rounds. You know, there's been a couple of rounds since Paul's been there, and I'd done several prior to that. So, looking back at, you know, when I'm advising companies as well, I always tell them to raise way more than you think you need to. Not because I did, but because I wish I had, you know.
Okay.
So the all that time you spend fundraising is taking you away from working on the business, you know. Communication and fundraising would be the two probably biggest areas that I learned from over that period. But you know, in general, we expanded headcount. We were getting more customers. We even did some TV advertising at one point. I think it was around 2014. With Sebastian Chabal, the rugby, dressed as a fairy. Something
I remember that now. It's hard not to.
Yeah. So that was an interesting time, and the ad itself did pretty well. But it's a long payback on that kind of expenditure. You know, we were still getting signups from that ad 2-3 years later.
Okay.
You know, in a direct response type thing, it's harder to measure. There were lots of highlights. We had some challenges as well. In fact, two external shocks, if you like, that came in fairly quick succession around late 2015 and then 2016, is we had our main banking partner. So we did, just to clarify, we do the international transactions through Currency Fair, and we clear at bank accounts locally in each country. So, you know, we have a banking partner in Australia that will accept money in Australia and pay it out in Australia, and that's how we're and likewise in euros and sterling and dollars and various other things. So what that allows us to do this so much more cheaply, because we're only using, you know, domestic banking systems, so we can do free transfers, you know, faster payments or SEPA payments on each end, and we handle the FX part. So we don't actually send money through a, you know, the old cumbersome international SWIFT thing, right? So that's one of the reasons it's cheaper. But you know, the ability to make and receive these payments is core to the model. And I think it was 2015, our main banking partner basically told us that we had 30 days and they were exiting the money services businesses, so that they were no longer interested in providing this functionality for us. Wow. Not that they felt there was anything wrong with this, just that they didn't want to do it anymore.
They were getting out that side of the business, or what was the reason?
Yeah, that's all they told us. Like, literally, it was that poorly done from our perspective. Now, we had some backups. We knew that was a critical part of our business, so we had some backups, right? But they weren't quite as ready to go as we thought they were. And even though we had no point where we couldn't make payments, we had a problem with, you know, we tried as best we could to notify all our customers to you know, our banking details have changed. You now need to send money into this account, not the original one.
Oh, I get you.
Turns out lots of people weren't either reading our emails, or maybe they were going to junk, or they weren't even logging in. So they kept sending money to these old bank accounts. Mm. So we ended up with not everyone, obviously, but a significant portion of people. And because this had been done by our banking partner so abruptly, they were not, we couldn't get that money back for them. We just had to wait. And the bank was taking sort of 4 or 5 weeks to bounce the money back to people. So obviously we had a customer services nightmare, if you like, trying to deal with all of these claims and tell people that, look, the money will be returned to you, but it's going to take a few weeks and we can't do anything about it. You know?
No one wants to hear that, really.
No, exactly. And it was really tough. And luckily it wasn't all our customers, and most of them had been notified, but still it was a tough period for us and for those customers who were affected by it. And then really in quick succession to that, we had Brexit. And specifically the vote of Brexit in 2016. And we found that as that was approaching, one of the things we learned is that people, when it comes to people, particularly expats, sending money, they don't just do it necessarily regularly every month. So some do, right? It's a pension and they need the money out in Spain. So every month they do a transfer. But what actually happens, and I find it quite fascinating, when I think about it, I would do the same thing myself, is that people tend to wait. If they've some discretion over the timing of the transaction, they will often wait. You know, and so you might get someone who's doing something every month for a while and then they stop for a few months. And then all of a sudden they do 3 or 4 months transfer at once. And when you analyze that data, you see that it's actually driven by where the exchange rate is. So if people are, say, Brits in Spain and sterling weakens, so they're suddenly like, oh, hang on, I'm not going to send money over when the rate's so bad. And then they wait. And then if the rate sterling rises, then people pile in and start transferring again.
That's so interesting. I didn't think people would be keeping such a close eye on it. I guess if it's your pension or whatever, you know, you're going to be keeping a close
eye. You see the difference, right? Yeah. If it drops. And so with Brexit coming up, sterling was kind of dropping. But most people, like myself included, thought that it would be a Remain vote and that as soon as the Remain vote happened, sterling would rebound. But what we saw was in that early period, you know, 3 or 4 months leading up to the vote itself, as sterling had weakened quite a bit, people were holding off and waiting and waiting. And so our volumes were kind of, which had been growing pretty strongly, it kind of leveled off. And at the same time, we'd had this we were dealing with this issues of transitioning these bank accounts. So as it turned out, when Brexit itself happened, we had an absolutely massive month because over the period, I remember staying up all night that night as the votes were coming in, and rates were every time a few votes came in one place or another, the rate would jump one way, and so it ended up being our, you know, I think that day we did almost as much as a normal month, you know, of transactions.
I was going to ask you, because surely that sparked massive panic of like, get the money out quickly.
Yeah, well, and then once it was a leave vote, then sterling obviously weakened even further than it had even the prior month. So I think after that, we had a slightly elevated month the next month, but then things kind of settled down, back down again. And so that was kind of tough as well, because at the time we'd sort of raised an amount of money and based it on where the revenue was going, and then we'd had a couple of shocks. And so you're having to deal with that kind of thing all the time, which then pushes you back to fundraising again more early than you'd like. And So that's just a few of the things that stick in my mind over the years. But
then Paul. So how did Paul transition into the business? You can take that, Brett, or Paul can kind of take that.
From my perspective, this was, I think, Paul, you were sort of coming on board just kind of after the Brexit vote, wasn't it? I think later that year.
Yeah, October timeframe, wasn't it? We started kind of chatting, and I got to know Brett and then got involved. First of all, just helping out Brett, and then we kind of flipped roles then, basically probably early in the new year sometime. Mm. It just kind of came pretty naturally in the end, like in terms of my, I suppose, previous experience being able to help Brett and the company, you know, scale a bit faster, basically as well. Brett wanting to be play more of a strategy type role in the company.
Were you a mentor, or were you hands-on? Were you actually in the office, or what?
No, I was in the office for a little bit, probably about a month or so. And then we just arranged it just to kind of flip the roles as such. That was probably towards the end of 16, early 17.
Yeah. Was that a strange transition for you, Brett? I mean, I can't imagine, you know, did you want to go as CEO and go strategic, or what was the thinking behind that?
I guess when I think about it, I really enjoy smaller companies in early stages. So I used to love it when we were all in one room or even two rooms. But as things got bigger, my role became, as CEO, became less about the things that I loved to do and was good at in terms of building product and solving those product related problems, and more around the sort of scaling type issues, which I'm not particularly good at, nor so I was learning to do stuff that wasn't in my nature. I wanted to get in there and do the product. So from my perspective, moving away from that role, which wasn't a good fit for me and I wasn't enjoying that much, and getting back into doing the more strategic elements, or even early stage, and now I'm doing a lot of mentoring sort of for other early stage sort of companies as well. It was was it strange? It was, it's obviously strange, because when something's been your whole life for a number of years, and it really is, and I'm sure any other founder would agree with me that, you know, you never switch off from your business when you're a founder and you're running it like weekends, evenings, and you know, it's probably not that healthy either, but that is the way it is. To not have, you know, that intense as direct level of responsibility was strange, but it was great.
It's incredible to meet someone who has that kind of level of self-awareness, who kind of knows what they want to do, but also, you know, doesn't have the ego stopping them of kind of going, do you know what? I actually don't want to do this anymore. Was there a moment where you were like, oh, do you know what? This actually might be a great solution just to slot Paul in. Was there an event or a moment that kind of sparked it off, or was it just kind of a gradual thing as Paul got more involved? You're like, this might transition well.
Well, it was actually even before I met Paul, I'd been starting to think along these lines that it might be good to find someone else who's more experienced at the bigger, the next stage, if you like. So it was something that had probably even earlier in 2016 had been something that I'd been starting to think about. It would have even been prior to meeting Paul. And then once Paul came along, and, you know, with his track record, and it made a huge amount of sense.
So Paul, you jumped in 2016, 2017, was it?
Yeah, it was kind of early 2017, I think, when we kind of probably kind of completed the transition over. And then since then, I guess we've been kind of taking on the company, right? And I know Brett Fields, because I remember sold two previous startups of my own. So I kind of absolutely empathize with what Brett's thoughts at the time, which kind of made it easier for the transition probably for both of us as well, right? Because, you know, I had walked in Brett's shoes in that role before as well. So, yeah, and then we took it on, took the business on, maintained the same ethos that Brett had started in terms of the customer first, employee first approach, very service oriented, employee relationship oriented as a company. And then we've been expanding since then. So we've expanded into Asia, which we did in last year, 2019. And we spent a lot of the year just building up our Asia business. We bought a small company in Hong Kong at the end of Christmas 2018. And then we set up in early 19, just like across Asia, in terms of opening up Singapore and Hong Kong as markets for us, and setting up a corridor into China. So trying to just take the business forward into a new, you know, faster growth markets. Like, in Asia is probably the fastest growing region for the currency pair type business model, which is international payments.
So let's finally get to the elephant in the room. Why we're all sitting in three different rooms and not having a chat over a nice coffee in the currency fair offices in Balls Bridge. So we're chatting.
Need the answer, Gary. We don't have good coffee.
Yeah. So we're chatting. It's April 2020, just for anyone listening in the future. We're in the middle of the COVID-19. I don't even know what you'd call it at this stage. So Paul, what, bring us through kind of your experiences of the last kind of, I suppose, month, over a month now, I guess we're experiencing it. When did you see things changing? When did you get an early bubble in the markets, or what drew your attention to this as an issue?
Yeah, well, for us, I guess we've had a phenomenal last couple of weeks of business, because a huge number of our customers who are trying to make sense of it themselves have been contacting us to kind of make bring forward some of their payments because there's so much currency volatility at the moment. So we've been, you know, up until now, we've basically been shielded a little bit from the economic impacts that other businesses have, and we're thankful for that. And I guess what really brought it home to us was the level of number of customers contacting us, right, trying to find out what they should do. Now, we don't provide advice, right, because we're not, you know, we're not an advisory business. But the number meant, and we would be quite close to a lot of our customers in terms of we know them reasonably well and they know us quite well at an individual level. So that was kind of the first hint that this was going to be a bigger issue, I think, economically than just a health issue. Was people in, you know, all parts of the world contacting us, wanting to know how they could get home, how they could get their money home. And I know there's been a lot of coverage in the Irish media of the, you know, people stuck in Peru, right? Which they got home, I think, last week. Well, one of those people was a good customer of ours, who I think half the company knows personally, mostly because he spends a lot of time on the phone talking to our staff about different things, right? So we could see that this was outside of Ireland. It was a bigger issue than even inside Ireland. I think the Irish impact obviously was felt when the, you know, restaurants started to close down and bars started to close. So we could see it. And because we have a pretty large presence in Asia, you know, we had seen it in Asia first, but then the impact in Asia wasn't as great because the number of cases was a lot lower than the cases in Europe. You know, the number of deaths other than China was quite low, and like Singapore and Hong Kong, you know, it was quite low. Singapore stayed open. They didn't have a lockdown until last week. Yeah. Hong Kong have been, people are working home since before Chinese New Year in January. So we've seen since January people working from home. And we are a work from anywhere type company. That, you know, it's all cloud based. People can dial in from anywhere. So we already could see it coming up slowly. I think what caught everybody out was the speed that the pandemic took over in Europe. Mm. And that's kind of, I suppose, accelerated our thinking around what we do going forward. So we'd be hopeful that Asia will recover faster than Europe, right? So from our point of view, we're really focused in on trying to scale and grow our Asia business, assuming that the European business will probably take a step back, you know, for a period of time, potentially for up to a year, potentially. Because nobody really knows, on, you know, how long it will take to get the virus under control. You know, will there have to be some kind of a treatment plan that's available, you know, really quickly, that someone does get sick, then people can get treated really easily and therefore you can open up, you know, traffic and trade again, because at least you can cure people who get sick. Yeah. Or we have to wait for a vaccine, which is like 18 months away. So, you know, so it's quite difficult to see the longer term future for that. So we're doing what everybody else is doing. We're planning for a business having to basically deal with lower revenues potentially. Hopefully it might not happen. And because as Brett said, when he started the company in a recession, it was providing great value for people in order to help them save money. That's what the company still does today. So like we're very focused in now on helping small businesses, you know, who are still trying to make payments, import goods from, you know, abroad to sell in Ireland. They're still selling into the UK market, for example, you know, trying to help them get better value for their sterling when they bring it back into euros here. So we've done a couple of things. Like we launched a campaign for in Ireland and Australia, because the two markets where the company was founded, as Brett said himself and Sean were Australian and the other two founders weren't. And the company was originally in Ireland and Australia. So we, in both markets, because they were our home markets as for the company, we offered a 15% rebate on any charges we make for any of your payments just to those companies in those markets. And it's primarily aimed at existing customers as well, to try and help them. Okay. You know, so we still think there's a lot of opportunity for the company in you know, what is a kind of very turbulent situation, to help people save money. And of course, the key thing, as Brett said earlier, is getting the message across. You know, you're trying to get people to see that there's alternatives, and it's difficult for people to see alternatives when they're so focused in on the here and now, you know. Yeah, but hopefully people will have time to step back over next week and go, you know what, okay, now I understand how big this crisis is. I can plan around it because I have a better context for how big it really is.
How do you plan as a CEO, though, of quite a large company? What's your process? Can maybe talk through that? Because a lot of listeners to the podcast are small business owners, maybe 0 to 10 employees. And they might actually even have, definitely don't have a plan in place for this, but they might have, you know, I'm sure you guys have contingency planning and emergency planning. So do you have a process in place so that when an event or a shock, as Brett called it earlier, happens, that you then put in place? Or is it, again, it's so fluid?
No, it's so fluid, but we're able to react pretty quickly, right? Because, you know, I suppose like everything else, when you've been around a while, you're used to shocks happening. We're fortunate that we have a lot of experienced people in the team, right? So a lot of people have, this isn't their first recession. unfortunately. So, you know, we're able to react pretty quickly, and we do. So we would take the view that you're better off taking action fast, and, you know, taking painful action and looking at it in a positive light. Like I would be like Brett, I'd be more an optimist. So, you know, we look at it, okay, we have a company, the company, you know, will be successful. Question is, how long will it, we have to basically go through a downturn before we can really bounce back. And when we bounce back, how we bounce back stronger, because we will bounce back stronger. That's the, you know, that's in our nature. You know, I've seen that before in the businesses we started in the past. You know, you absorb a shock and it makes you stronger, right? So we plan for that, and we plan and we communicate with the employees, and we have to take tough cost measures. We take them because you're ultimately trying to protect the interests of all your employees, right, and all your customers. And that's what you got to think in that light. And unfortunately, you can't obsess around one individual, like, or which could be yourself, or it could be one employee, you know, who has a particular, I suppose, financial commitment that you're trying to go, how do I help that person to get around that? You got to look at the bigger picture, in terms of what's right for the company and what's right for all the employees as a group. And it's hard. But you got to make quick decisions and not, you know, and then take the opportunity when you've made the decisions to step back and go, okay, am I making the right decisions? What kind of business do I want to come back as? You know, when things improve, and things will improve. Like we were just thinking, and we were working over the weekend on this in communication plan was, in the context of everybody working from home, let's say you have young children, right? They're probably at this stage getting under your feet in the house. But in 6 months' time, you'll probably look back and go, geez, that was great to be able to spend so much time with my kids, so rather than spend an hour and a half in the car each way commuting to work. You know, you look back and you'll see the positives in it.
Yeah.
And that's what we say to all our employees. Look at the positives now, right? You know, yes, you're working at home. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, it's uncertain. But at the end of the day, you still have your health, right? You don't have a commuting time. It's spend more time with your families. And when this is all over, there'll probably be a whole change in the whole working environment generally for people.
I was going to ask you that. Do you think this is, obviously remote working was bubbling and was coming. Do you think this has just skyrocketed that, or will it be people will be like, oh, geez, I want to go back to the office?
I think people want to go back to the office part-time because like we're humans, right? We need social interaction. In fact, we'd be advocating at a personal level for a whole change in their working model. Like we haven't seen now the way people work and haven't seen how we work actually works abroad, right? Because we operate at some WeWork offices internationally that, you know, why can't you advocate in Ireland for like working hubs in commuter towns where people can, you know, share space with other companies in the town. And then maybe you commute into the Dublin 1 or 2 days a week. Right,
but there's an Irish guy working on an idea like that. I might connect you with him if you haven't met him already. I'll connect you with him after.
Because I think that's the way. Because it solves two issues. It solves the housing crisis to a certain extent because it means now you can afford to live, you know, way down the country, right? You know, and I'm from the country, so I can say this. Yeah, that you can live. You know, you can live in Offaly or Laois or Westmeath and commute halfway to Dublin, right? To a hub and share that hub like a mini WeWork office. And then come into Dublin 1 or 2 days a week. So you can then build your family life and whatever else outside of Dublin where housing is better value, there's more land available. And you'd hope to be quicker access to housing because things could maybe move a bit quicker. So like, I think we have to, as a country, take the current crisis and then rethink how we actually work, right? As an economy and not have everybody chasing trains and traffic into Dublin every day to work in wherever it is in the center of Dublin. Like, you know, ultimately Dublin is on the coast. Right, it's like San Francisco or Boston. You know, you have to come from west to east or north to south. Right, it's not as you can't live on four sides of the country. And then there's mountains on one part of it, so there's not a lot of routes in or spokes into the hub. So we got to find a smarter way to work. And I think working from home will become much more the norm. You know, for people. And we because we have a number of smaller offices around the world, Dublin being the main office. We kind of have that like hub and spoke mentality anyway. Now, obviously people don't commute to Dublin from Singapore or Australia too frequently, but it's the same type of model, right?
Yeah.
You know, and we have people who go there, for example. You know, I'm obviously traveling a fair bit where I was traveling a fair bit anyway, as was Brett before me. So in that sense, I'm connecting back with everybody in each of the countries we operate in. So I think that will become the new normal for work. And I think it will make the country a better place actually in terms of better quality of life for everybody, less greenhouse emissions, greenhouse gases, better climate, more time at home, less time in traffic.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think exactly the same as yourself. I used to do 2 days at home, Monday, Friday. I just sandwiched a week. I think that's exactly what people do. I think this will give people a lot of pause for thought. People who probably never had the opportunity to work from home, who never kind of knew what it might be like. And also employers like yourselves, people who will evolve their model now to cater to people's new demands. Because I think people will come back from this going, look, exactly what you said there. I need to spend a bit more time with my kids. I need to cut that commute down. It's killing me. This, I have a whole new respect for working from home now. And then Brett, for yourself, how has this last couple of weeks been?
A little bit surreal in some ways, as I think it has been for everyone. I definitely think it's, luckily I'm in a period where I'm not full-time working at the moment. So what I would normally be doing now is probably going into Dogpatch Labs and helping out with some incubator programs that would have been due to start in the next week or two, but that's probably postponed. So I've just really been doing my own thing. There's a couple of things I'm working on as well, and I'm learning Spanish, so I'm keeping busy, but nice. It's strange. But I think it's, there's a reasonable chance, as Paul said, that we're a reasonable long way from an actual definitive end to this. Now, there may be ways that it lightens up a bit. So you could see us sort of coming partially out of lockdown, or, maybe wearing face masks a lot and being tracked on our phones so that we, a lot of testing and tracking and that kind of thing. But it's a reasonable chance that, for a good few months, it's going to be at least a good few months, I'd say, before life goes back to what it used to be completely normally. So I think we're definitely accelerating changes that might have taken 10 years to happen in the absence of this into a much smaller period of time. I know socially, I'm sure I'm not alone of having caught up with some mates over drinks over Zoom in the last few weeks, which is a kind of strange experience, but it's starting to feel like the new normal. Interesting times. Obviously, we're all trying to do our bit, I guess. And we do get out and do a bit of exercise, but literally in our household, staying home pretty much the whole time, just going out to the shops when we need to, because whilst we're probably not in a high risk category at our ages, there are people that are. So, it's a bit of people pulling together at the same time. It'll be a strange thing to look back on anyway, and hopefully it won't be as bad as it could be.
Yeah, you were CEO for, as you said it yourself, a couple of shocks. So one thing I'm kind of fascinated by at the minute is reaction. Underreaction, reaction, overreaction. How did you find that for your shocks? How did you know, right, this is where we need to be, we need to act fast, or we need to take a moment, or we need to, how did you balance that?
It's a good question. Because I guess depending on the nature of the shock, you kind of don't know, including this one, where it's going to go. So you're never really going to know what's the appropriate level of action, So it is probably best in that sense to overreact rather than underreact. In other words, assume that it's going to be worse than it will probably be, because it's easier to pull back from taking extra action and then wind it back if it's no longer necessary than it is to take a bit of action, then have to take more action, then more action, then more action. So I think worst case scenario analysis is super important here. And, companies, any businesses, I'm sure, is looking at their cash flow now and assuming that the worst case on their revenue, even if you're an early stage company, assuming your revenue is zero for a while, or whatever's appropriate in the kind of business you're in, and then mapping out your cash flow accordingly, looking at where you can extend it and all the different options, and making that a key focus. So yeah, I would err on the side of caution in a shock like this one.
Well, for yourselves, as you look kind of, again, just echoing what Brett said there, you said the same thing in terms of react quick and react hard. What's your kind of plan as you live with the uncertainty of the next kind of couple of weeks or months or whatever it would be? How do you see Currency Fair kind of moving through the next couple of months?
No, we're very focused in on, and Brett, I think, touched on it there in terms of how we react, right, and plan for. So we will be probably plan on a much more conservative scenario than hopefully it'll turn out to be the case. So you don't, you end up being positively surprised rather than negatively surprised. And that would be what we do. The last thing you really want to try and avoid is the old scenario of debt by 1,000 cuts, right? So, you know, you're over optimistic, you make a change, it doesn't work, you make another change, and suddenly, you know, you're four changes in and you're still struggling to get ahead of yourself. So we would probably kind of plan for a much more conservative scenario on day one, and then track and track and track and make sure that, you know, we weren't optimistic, because you don't know in the current shock environment what an optimism is or pessimism is. It'll just be a new reality every day. So you just plan for what you think might happen conservatively, and then you just execute accordingly, you know, and changes in your cost structures or whatever, or changes in your marketing strategy. You know, we'll be realigning, for example, more our sales and marketing strategy towards Asia, because we do think ultimately Asia will recover faster. You know, China is already trying to get their factories back up. We have a business in and out of China, they're trying to get the factories back to 60-70% capacity this month. You know, so I know they took a step back the weekend when they had more new cases of COVID-19 in the country. But still, they are moving forward, right? You know, they've celebrated the martyrs of the pandemic as last week. So they're moving forward. So that's what we'll be focusing on. Where can we engineer growth from? You know, because not every business is in decline, right? So, you know, some, like any medtech businesses, particularly anybody in the PPC or PPE world, basically are doing quite well. Certain types of e-commerce business doing quite well, and we can see how we can service those businesses. Like, and some of our customers' businesses have been decimated. Like, we would deal a lot with, say, car garages importing cars into Ireland. Mm. Like, for example, their business is zero. So, you know, it's trying to find green shoots of opportunity for every business. And I think if you cut hard early, you buy more time to find that rather than constantly chasing the next cost cut. As Brett said, like, cut hard and cut early. And while you might be an optimist as a business leader and a founder of the company, you need to be a pessimist in a shock, and then, you know, give yourself more time to react, to chase new business opportunities, or, you know, use the opportunity to refocus on what type of business you actually want to be, you know, in a year's time, and then work into that plan. That's what we're doing.
We're close to wrapping up, so I'll just ask you, Paul, you've nearly answered it there, but I'll just ask you both one last question. If you were, you know, an entrepreneur running a smaller business, say between one and five people, what would you be doing now to kind of prepare yourself, as you said there, Paul, for a kind of a post-COVID world of, you know, green shoots? Or what would you be doing now to help yourself prepare for the next 6 months? Start with you, Paul, and wrap up with Brett.
Okay, well, I think first thing I do is I'd have to realign my cash flow and figure out, okay, what, like, do I have enough money for a year, right, roughly? Do I, and if I don't, how do I get that cash? Do I have to bring in revenue to make the number, because I can't get it from elsewhere? Okay, what revenue do I need to bring in, and where do I get it from? I'm trying to figure out what changes you think are going to happen, right? You know, like the whole change in the working model, working from home, does that open an avenue of opportunity for your business in terms of how those people get serviced? Like, you know, simple examples, we've seen it lately, all the restaurants reopening as takeaways, right? That's a new business model. It keeps the restaurants going. So try and figure out, are there ways you can adapt your business to the change in economic world in the next 12 months? Or if you can't, okay, what do you need to do to mothball and try and figure out what the world will look like in 12 months' time in terms of the business you used to have? Will it be the same business? You know, in terms of, it's a manufacturing company, will people want to buy the same things you're manufacturing, or do you need to repurpose your factory or your outlet, or will you have the same demand for your goods in foreign markets as you have today? And try and buy yourself time to think, to step back and think it through, right? And think it through logically, and, you know, in terms of planning different outcomes. And if you have the time because you've cut hard, then you will have the time to step back and go, okay, look, let me take a few days now to kind of step back here and think about it. Because every month will bring new information, and you have to be very flexible. You have to be able to change on a dime, you know, literally, because there will be, you know, there might be a release of the lockdown, in which case manufacturing might get started again. It might go the opposite way, in which case some factories may never reopen. Then you got to look, well, then there's import substitution. Can you import those goods that used to be manufactured here from somewhere else, like China or somewhere in Asia? So I think just be flexible, but look, just keep watching your cash flow the whole time and try and figure out what business you want to be.
Brilliant. Brett?
Yeah, well, I think Paul pretty much captured it there.
what he said.
I'd agree 100%. I mean, absolute first point is cash flow and runway. Like, that was the first thing I'd be looking at. What is my runway, and assuming a worst case revenue situation? And then if that's not at least a year, you've got to look at what you can do to get it to a year. So that's your absolute first point. And once you've got that into a situation where you're more comfortable, or as comfortable as you can be, and taking whatever decisions, use whatever tools, looked at government supports, looked at everything you can do to get that runway sorted, then I think, as Paul said, you've got to start taking a view on the world and where it's going, and you know, with the lens of your own business, in what ways can you adapt or change that to fit in better with the way you think things are going to turn out.
Brilliant. Listen, Paul, Brett, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me today.
No problem at all. It's been brilliant.
Cheers, Gary.
Thank you very much, guys. And that was episode 47 of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with Brett Myers and Paul Byrne from Currency Fair. Hope you enjoyed it. If you are an entrepreneur and you've got a great story to tell, I am looking for entrepreneurs for the new season of the Entrepreneur Experiment. So do get in touch, and I'll see you back here next week, Thursday at 6 a.m. Chat to you then.